Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, both of my guests today looked wilderness in the face and in doing so formed unbreakable bonds between man and beast and ultimately found themselves and their place. And I'm really looking forward to talking to both of my guests today because they've both written really superb books. Our second segment today is about a man named Tom, a little dog named Atticus, and the 48 high peaks of New Hampshire. Newspaper man Tom Ryan quit publishing to go on the journey of a lifetime, which he shares in his lyrical narrative of friendship, family, love, and loyalty. Atticus led, says Tom. I followed. And in the end, I became the man I dreamed of being when I was a little boy. But my first guest today is Ceridwen Terrell. I think it's fair to say that you'd expect a woman whose name is derived from the goddess of poetic inspiration to be far from ordinary. And that's certainly true in this case. Ceridwen Terrell is an associate professor at Concordia University in Portland, Oregon. She teaches environmental journalism and science writing. And when she's not teaching or writing, she's sailing the San Juans, jumping horses, topping out on Mount Hood, free climbing through the narrow canyons of Utah, or backpacking with her dog. She's also the author of Part Wild, One Woman's Journey with a Creature Caught Between the Worlds of Wolves and Dogs. Ceridwen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Vicki. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, Ceridwen, they say there are no coincidences. And when I was prepping for today's show, I thought this was really strange. Your book begins with a quote from the exact same author that my second guest ends his book with. And I wanted to begin with the quote that you begin your book with. It's from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. And you begin with a quote, "You become responsible forever for what you have tamed." Tell us what that meant to you and why you started your book with that quote.
Thank you for asking that. That quote for me meant that you see something through, that you make a choice, that you connect with an animal, and even though you make many mistakes or many journeys you take with that animal, you have to see it through, however it happens, whether it's happy or it's sad, and you have to make decisions and you have to live with them, which is why I chose that, because I've had to live with the decisions that I've made and the mistakes that I've made, which is why I wrote Part Wild. And so for me, beginning the book with that quote is a way to set up the tone for the story.
Really well-written book, a riveting story. It's heartwarming and heartbreaking. It's a memoir, but you also wrote a lot of science into this book without it being a textbook, of course. You traveled across the world, it seems, to do a lot of research on wolves. So I want to just back up a little and tell us when your fascination with wolf dogs. I read that you grew up loving dogs. One day you met a wolf dog and decided there and then, hey, that's the dog for me.
I really, truly was misguided. I have always loved dogs, as the book mentions. But I had escaped from a pretty dangerous and unhealthy relationship, so it was a particularly sad and frightening time for me in my life when I start the book. And I really foolishly bought into a myth that circulates and still circulates out there, that wolves and wolf dogs are more protective as companion animals than domestic dogs. That's not true. Actually, wonderfully, wolves don't like conflict. It's actually, they try to avoid it. It's the dog part that is so protective. But I bought into that myth foolishly. I also wanted a wilderness companion because I spent a lot of time on long treks on difficult terrain. And I thought, well, what better animal than a wolf dog? And, you know, again, a myth. But I made some foolish choices, some foolish mistakes, guided by, unfortunately, pain. And so I sought healing through an animal, which is not, you know, there's a time and a place for that, because the dog, the domestic dog, is perfect for that. But an animal like a wolf or a wolf dog, it's unfair to seek your healing through that kind of an animal.
Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit about how you put this memoir together in a moment. But a little piece I want to read from the book. You say Inyo, and is that how you say her name?
Inyo? Yes.
Inyo and I were supposed to be partners. She would protect me from people who wanted to hurt me because, as you said, you'd been through this horrendous, dangerous, abusive relationship. And she would be the loyal companion I relied on to stick close. But Inyo could not be my guardian. Instead, I was hers. Not only did I have to shield her from the world, I had to shield the world from her. So you put this book together. Why did you want to write the book? Let's start there.
Sure. I needed to write this book. It's dedicated to Inyo. And the reason why I wanted to write it is because I wanted to reveal all the wrong reasons for that someone would get a wolf dog, because that was me, the naive young woman who believed certain things but didn't have enough information, made the wrong choices. I wanted to tell this book in all its honesty. I wanted to be blatant about it and real. I wanted to tell the difficult story, not just the warm, fuzzy story. I wanted to tell the tough story, because I think that is the way that we can ultimately, as human beings, improve our relationships with animals. And wolves, wild wolves, need all the help they can get right now. And so I wanted to tell this story about Inyo, about our relationship, our close relationship, but also our trials together, our difficulties, our adventures in the wilderness, which we had many, and then the difficulties we faced when we had to come back home to the city.
And it wasn't, you know, I've seen a lot of wolf dogs around lately. And just to put this in perspective, Inyo, her father was 100% wolf, her mother 75% wolf and 25% husky, correct?
Correct. That's what the breeder told me.
Yeah. Did you doubt that?
You know, I have questions about, because breeders often inflate the amount of wolf in an animal in order to sell it for a higher price. Mm. The woman that I got Inyo from actually wasn't looking to make money. She didn't have any reason to lie. After having traveled so much and having met so many different animals, both pure wolves and wolf dogs of every different combination, I feel pretty confident that Inyo was what would be considered a high-content wolf dog. But I mostly base that on taking the animal in its totality, which is to say its coat, its feet, its ears, its muzzle, its teeth. But not only that, its behavior. How does it respond to the world? How does it respond to other people? And to change, because wolves are very wary, very shy animals. Inyo could be very, very shy, very, very unlike the gregarious Siberian husky.
Right, right. Now, in all of this research, you spent 5 years researching wolves. I mean, you really did a lot of research on this and wolf dog breeds and wolf
yes.
dog breeders. You went to Germany, to Siberia. I mean, you went all over the place. And I read in the book that wolf dog breeders believe that introducing a wild streak into the dog genome helps to reverse the damage caused by domestication. It makes them smarter, stronger, more independent. You don't agree with that?
I don't. In fact, it's a really important point that you bring up there, and I'm so glad you did, because a lot of the wolf dog breeders that I met and wolf dog owners really keep emphasizing how smart wolves and wolf dogs are. And yes, indeed, they're incredibly smart. But on the flip side, they put down the domestic dog as being stupid. Their love comes too easy, so it's not worthwhile. They prefer to have to earn the trust and love of a more difficult animal, and that really is an unfairness to dogs, because dogs are designed to live with people. They have a wonderful complex set of skills that allows them to live with us so well. And wolves and many wolf dogs have drives, these natural drives inside of them that they cannot help, like prey drive and territorial defense. And of course, dogs have some of this as well, but they're much more able to contain it than a wolf or many wolf dogs that I have met are able to do. And, you know, wolves want to roam. they travel 30 to 50 miles a day in the wild. They have territories of up to 360 square miles or more in some places. They want to hunt, they want to mate, form packs, and they can't do that in captivity, and they get extremely frustrated. So to put dogs down for being very smart in the niche that they occupy, which is the human home, is just, it's unfounded and unrealistic and unfair.
Yeah. And one another reason you wanted to get a wolf dog was that you are a very active woman. I mean, you are an environmental journalist and science writer, but when you're not doing that, you're out in the wilderness yourself.
I am.
And you really believe that a regular dog couldn't keep up with you.
The naive narrator does. Yes, the naive young woman of those years ago certainly did. I no longer believe that, for sure. That's long in the past.
Right.
The dog that I raised alongside Inyo Argos, who's still going strong now. He's 11, and he's in the wilderness with me all the time. And he's fantastic. Fantastic and athletic and graceful. And he's not a wolf dog. He's a street dog from the pound.
Right. Well, I know that you were told when you were hunting around breeders, and it took several tries, it was quite difficult for you actually to hook up with a dog, surprisingly, because, I know at least two down by my local beach, and then I've seen three or four up at Marymore Park up here in Redmond area. But you were told that the wolf hybrid is an incorrect term. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to ask you about that.
Yes.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest is Caradwyn Terrell in this segment, and her book is called Part Wild, part memoir and part science. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicky at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Tired of the insanity of other talk radio stations? Just click your radio knob and say there's no place like Alternative Talk 1150.
Well, we are talking today with Caradwyn Terrell in this segment, and I welcome you back. Her book is called Part Wild, One Woman's Journey with a Creature Caught Between the Worlds of Wolves and Dogs. And I want to just touch on this quickly, Caradwyn, and then I want to talk about some of the challenges that you faced trying to rear your puppy dog hybrid wolf. But you were actually told when you were looking that the term hybrid is incorrect.
I was told that, and you know the reason that where that's coming from is that in 1993 the Smithsonian Institution reclassified the dog as Canis lupus familiaris, so basically a domesticated wolf, and that was not in agreement across the world. That was American scientists that did that. So if I were speaking with European scientists, they looked at me askance when I said that the dog was basically a subspecies of the wolf. They thought that was positively ridiculous, that wolves and dogs are different species. They are not the same species. And, you know, there is only a 0.2% difference in the mitochondrial DNA of wolves and dogs, which is the DNA passed from mother to offspring. And that doesn't sound like much, but dogs and wolves have a totally different physiological makeup. Their hormones are different. Dogs have a higher level of serotonin, what we call the happy hormone, which is the sort of relax and chill out hormone.
That explains a lot.
It does. And wolves have a higher cortisol level, which is that fight or flight hormone that keeps them safe and alert in the wilderness. That doesn't work very well in a human home. Wolves and dogs also have those different behaviors, very different behaviors, and they live in very different places. They're adapted. One is adapted for the wild. The other is adapted for a domestic situation. And, you know, they have different seasonal reproduction as well. Wolves only mate once a year and have pups. Dogs are twice a year. So there's a lot of difference between the two. And so to just say that, you know, there is no difference between dogs and wolves aside from training is nonsense.
That explains the subtitle on your book, the part wild, and the second part is One Woman's Journey with a Creature Caught Between the Worlds of Wolves and Dogs. Because, and you say yourself, when you're writing this book, because it's memoir, but you also wanted to get the science end of things out there too, that it meant that you became like a wolf dog yourself, a child of two worlds.
Yes. I had to write both the memoir and the science because the naive me, those years ago, you know, I have to tell that story, where I was at the time when I made these bad decisions, these wrong decisions, and struggled. And then the wiser narrator is in control of the material and is telling the story and learning as she goes why things went the way they did.
Yeah. Well, you took a fair amount of criticism from some critics about adopting this dog in the first place, but you've also, those same critics also gave you incredible credit for writing this book, for being so honest about your feelings and your failings and the failings with the wolf dog. How difficult for you was this to write? I would imagine it was very difficult.
It's actually like when I was writing, it's like living it again, and you know, I felt like I was living the same stuff over again as I was writing it, because the wiser me now had at times to suspend, and I had to hold that part of me back. There were times writing this book where I wanted to pull myself out of the pages and shake me, the me that I was then. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking? What are you doing? That doesn't make any sense. But I had to set that aside and just tell the story as it happened. And I'm hoping, my biggest hope is that, you know, people would read the book and not make the same mistakes that I made.
Right.
That they would see the folly of it, but understand also, you know, the reasons why people want wolves and wolf dogs. Because they're, you know, people want them for different reasons. You know, some people want them because they see wolves and wolf dogs as a kind of a symbol of power. Some of the people I met were kind of those macho types, these aggressive mm-hmm. types mm-hmm. that saw wolves and wolf dogs as a kind of weapon. Some people wanted them for prestige. I mean, Michael Jackson himself had 5 Arctic wolves at his Neverland Ranch. But when he got bored with them, he sent them off to sanctuary. Thank goodness there was a place for them to go. Because I will tell you, Vicki, that sanctuaries in this country are full to the brim yeah. with unwanted wolves and wolf dogs. And, you know, Michael Jackson wanted them for aesthetic reasons, little lawn ornaments. And, you know, some people want them for personal worth, for a sense of that personal worth. And, you know, for me, my desire for them was equally weak, which was this notion of healing and also for protection. That's, you know, good intentions, is the good intentions that I had, good intentions won't cut it with these animals. It's not enough.
Right.
It's just not enough.
And I mean, there's no doubt that you loved her, because that comes across in the book, but things did start getting very difficult. And as you said, you know, you had to protect her from the world, not just the world from her. I remember reading, for example, that she actually attacked a dog while you were running in the desert behind your home. And so her world and your world got even smaller, because then you had to set your alarm at 3 a.m. to start running her when nobody else was around.
That's right. Yes, we got up really early because, you know, we had to run at least 2 hours a day. It didn't matter the weather, snow, rain, sleet. We went, and nevertheless, that was still not enough. But we had to go at times where we wouldn't run into other people, particularly as she began to mature. And even though she was spayed, it made no difference in the drive. Some people had told me, well, if you just spay and neuter a wolf dog, you will have less trouble. But that's actually not true. And it depends on the animal. You know, some wolf dogs do okay in domestic situations, I should say. I have met them that they are doing well. But they are the exception, not the rule. And so we went out at very odd hours to get our exercise so we wouldn't run into people and conflict. So, yeah, scheduling got pretty crazy.
Yeah. And one of your biggest critics, I think, was Patricia McConnell, Dr. Patricia McConnell, who's a certified applied animal behaviorist. And you're not hiding this criticism. I got this from your website.
Yes, yes.
But she does rebuke you for, you know, she says the same thing that you said about yourself when she was reading, that she wanted to reach into the pages of the book and pull you out and go, what were you thinking? because when your dog killed a neighbor's cat. But she also, you know, applauds you for being so honest in here. And her hope is like your hope. She says, I hope she wrote this book, you know, so that people understand these are different to dogs. These are not dogs with a little wild streak in them. These are very different creatures.
Yes. And that, you know, and I was ready for that kind of criticism, because honestly, no one could criticize me more than I do
right,
myself,
right.
Which is why I had to write the book, because I believe that writers have to tell the hard stories. I mean, that's part of our job. We have to tell the tough stories, because that is what will make our relationships to animals more informed, more knowledgeable, more humane.
Mm-hmm. So tell me what kind of challenges, when you started having challenges, and I know you said that the average life of a wolf in Yellowstone is like 3.4 years, which
correct.
I was really shocked to read that.
Yeah.
But what kind of challenges did you have with Inya? When did they start?
Mm-hmm.
When did you start having them?
Well, the challenges actually began pretty much right away with the in puppyhood. But at being that she's so tiny, it was a little easier to manage. As she grew and started to mature, some of these more wolfy drives started to show up. Prey drive was a big, big one. When she wanted to hunt, she always remembered where the animals were that she was interested in, like the goats down the street. And every chance she got, she would do her best to escape and go down and attack. And, of course, what everyone remembers when there's either a captive wolf or a wolf dog involved in some kind of a livestock incident, or a domestic pet has been attacked or killed, they remember the word wolf. They don't remember the word wolf dog,
right,
or dog. And so I was doing an enormous disservice to wolves by allowing this to happen, although I did my best at the time to prevent it. But so prey drive was strong. That was a real problem. But what allowed her to act on that is her drive to not be contained. She escaped everything that I constructed for her to keep her in, including a 5,000 volt of electricity perimeter fence around the enclosure where I kept her. She braved that electricity. It didn't matter to her the shock she was getting. She wanted out, out, out. And she knew what was causing that electricity, and she actually tore the control box off of the side of the house, off the mounting brackets, and
wow.
Chewed them up.
Wow.
Because she recognized that the electricity was pulsing from there. Very, very smart animal, incredibly graceful, and incredibly determined to be free. But, of course, you cannot let these animals free. I've met a lot of people who have told me that they actually let their wolf dog go, thinking that they were doing the animal a favor, that it would go and join a wild wolf pack. I've met people who have sanctuaries where the animals were tied up outside with little notes tucked in their collars, please teach me to hunt and set me free like the wild wolf I was meant to be. People are delivering not only a death sentence to that animal by turning it loose in the wilderness, but they're also, if that animal does survive, which is highly unlikely, it would probably be killed by wild wolves as an intruder. If it did survive and was able to mate, then we're looking at a watered-down gene pool.
Wow.
In the wild wolf population. So there's a number of reasons not to just simply let an animal go. You can't do that.
Right, right. Well, I read that there are approximately 300,000 of these wolf dogs in America. I read also that these are animals, wolves are animals that neither need nor want a bond with humans. So maybe that's where we need to start thinking about this. A final thought, I know you're big into getting the word out about this. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Caradwyn?
I would say, you know, that with all those animals in captivity and all the pure wolves in captivity, there's at least 1,500 licensed pure wolves and untold numbers of unlicensed pure wolves. And the fact is, the bottom line of all of that is that there are more of these animals in captivity than there are wild wolves in all of North America. There's something deeply troubling about this. And I think that if people want a wolfy dog, adopt a husky mix or a malamute mix from the pound. You know, we have 6 to 8 million cats and dogs that enter our shelters every year. Extraordinary animals mm-hmm. in need of homes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say, you know, really rescue an animal and love wolves in the wild, because to love them is to leave them wild.
Yes.
And if you love dogs, then keep those animals close to us.
Yeah, and they are beautiful, beautiful creatures. I can understand the appeal. I totally understand it. But I think your book is a testament to maybe the way we should be thinking. I thank you for being with us, and thank you for writing this book. It's an important book.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicki. I really appreciate getting a chance to talk with you.
Yeah, my pleasure. And my guest there, Caradwyn Terrell, her book, Part Wild, One Woman's Journey with a Creature, Caught Between the Worlds of Wolves and Dogs. Well, we're going to move from wolves and wolf dogs in a moment to miniature schnauzer. So please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Whether you want to write for business, for pleasure, or for publication, there's writing that works and writing that doesn't. So stop procrastinating and start today. Sign up for Writing That Gets Results with Vicki St. Clair and put your words to work. Vicki is a multidisciplinary writer, author, and communications consultant, and in 4 hands-on workshop sessions can help you focus your thoughts, identify your market, create your outline, and find your voice. Call Vicki St. Clair for full details at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or email info@conversationslive.net.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk 1150 covers it all.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I want to, before I introduce my next guest, just give you Caradwyn's website. I forgot, and I usually do that. It is myurbanwild.com. Her book is Part Wild. And check out myurbanwild.com. Well, we're going to go from a wolf dog to a miniature schnauzer, but boy, this dog has a lot of personality. My next guest is Tom Ryan, and Let me just get my notes here because I'm all messed up. There we go. Tom Ryan is the founder of the Newburyport newspaper, The Undertoad. He served as its publisher for over a decade and sold the newspaper and moved to the White Mountains of New Hampshire to write. Over the past 5 years, he and his climbing partner, Atticus Maxwell Finch, climbed more than 450 4,000-foot peaks in New Hampshire. And Tom Ryan's new book is called Following Atticus, 48 Peaks, One Little Dog, and an Extraordinary Friendship. Tom Ryan, welcome.
Thank you for having us on. Good afternoon.
Well, we're going to go from a story that didn't end out quite so well to a story that did. I mean, this is really a story of love lost, but also loyalty, friendship, an incredible story and superbly well written. I really did enjoy it. But I want to go back a little and just start with where you were before you even had a dog, because you weren't particularly looking for a dog. You were running this newspaper. You say in the book that you led a most unusual life. Some would even say it was exciting. You were the editor, publisher, and lone employee of your own newspaper. You were poor but influential, happy but stressed, fulfilled in your work but not in your life. So tell us what life was like and what you were missing back then.
I was a stressed individual, as I say. I was blessed as a writer who had never really written before, except for a couple of letters to the editor, to move to a great town called Newburyport, Massachusetts, on the North Shore, in the throes of gentrification. The old was being washed away, the new was coming in, and there was a somewhat uncivil behind-the-scenes war going on. We had our first female mayor, and it just so happens, not only being female, she was also a relative newcomer, and she was a lesbian. And I stepped into town right when she was running for re-election in a very nasty re-election bid, and I started writing about it. And I didn't know enough about it. I think some of the things, I'm blessed to know that ignorance is bliss now. I didn't know anything about writing a newspaper. I just wanted a fair fight. I have an Irish background and like to argue on occasion. And I didn't like the reasons they were going after this woman. And so I decided to even up the score a little bit by jumping in on her side.
And you talk about the town you lived in, Newburyport, as part Norman Rockwell, Norman Rockwell meets Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes, it was a great town and a great place for a new writer to earn his chops, as you might say. There was always something going on. There was great characters to write about. And people loved to talk, and no one had written most of the stories, even though we had a couple of newspapers in town.
Mm. Now, your life began to change when somebody, I think her name was Nancy, asked you to put an ad in the newspaper for this little miniature schnauzer that was not wanted, Maxwell Garrison Gillis. Tell us how he came into your life.
Well, he came at a most interesting time. You know, I don't read... ironic, I don't read books about dogs. I'm told that Caesar says something about the fact that we don't choose the dogs, they sort of choose us.
I believe that too.
they come into our life at the right moment. At that moment, I was going through a lot of stress. My tires and my car were continually slashed. I received death threats. People often said, why didn't you call the police? I said, well, I was afraid the police were the ones making the death threats. Windshield smashed. My exhaust pipe was filled up with spray insulating foam. And one night I came back from City Hall, and my trash was missing from the curb. It later turned out the police were actually going through my trash, trying to find what they could find on me, because I'd been writing about their misdeeds. They were looking for who knows what, anything they could pin on me. Luckily, they didn't find anything but Big Mac wrappers and Ben and Jerry containers. And at this time, this woman reached out and said, listen, we have this dog, and we're trying to find a home. If we can't find him a home, we'll probably go to the shelter, and he probably won't make it because he's old, and he's been neglected for years. And would you please help us put an ad in the paper? And I said, yes. And I was writing back, of course I will. I didn't have much money, so I always gave free ads for good causes. But unbeknownst to me, my fingers wrote something else. I said, I'll take him.
I know that feeling.
And I didn't know what the heck a miniature schnauzer was. My worst thoughts were those little yappers who lady knit sweaters for. And I quickly looked it up in the you know, on Wikipedia, what is this dog? And I'm like, oh, my God, it is one of those horrible things. And Max came into my life in pretty much the same shape I was in at the time, disheveled, a bit neglected, a bit dysfunctional. And yet, within hours, we found a bond. I'm not sure why. I guess two ships passing in the night, and we became fast friends.
Right. Well, I want to. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about Maxwell a little. I know that you became inseparable with him, and then of course we have to introduce Atticus and what Atticus meant to you. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest in this segment is Tom Ryan, and he's written a great book. It's called Following Atticus: 48 High Peaks, One Little Dog, and an Extraordinary Friendship. And I wish this was television and I could show you a picture of him, because he's gorgeous, the little dog. Okay, we'll be right back.
They're man's best friend. The girls can make you feel cold, can make you feel old, an antique to be sold. The girls are playing with your heart.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicky at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Feed your mind and your body and spirit will follow. Alternative Talk, 1150.
But the dogs don't depend on a thing. They just lick your face as they see it. And oh, the dogs don't depend on a thing. And maybe that's why they're man's best friend. The girls should know that they're vain.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Tom Ryan, former newspaper man. He's written a fabulous book called Following Atticus, 48 High Peaks, One Little Dog, and an Extraordinary Friendship. Tom, before the break, we were talking about your first dog, who was a miniature schnauzer. You adopted him in a pretty poor state, and he was elderly and not very well, and he did pass away, but during the time you were together, you really bonded. You became inseparable. He went to the city hall and meetings with you. And I read that he got over 50 sympathy cards when he little thing passed away.
Yes, I did. He had made his little mark on Downtown Newburyport.
There you go. And so then how did Atticus come into your life? Tell us about Atticus.
Well, I had rescued Max, and then he lasted about a year and a half. And as you said, we became fast friends. Before long, he was going everywhere with me. And unfortunately, seizures started after about a year and a half, and they progressed rapidly, and I had to put him down. In my paper, I was writing a column about my experiences in Newburyport in a more personal way, writing back to my father, called The Letter Home. And Max had become quite a character in town, and so people got to know about him and what I wrote about him and our experiences together. And when he passed away, as you know, the sympathy cards came in, as you just stated. But I decided I needed to have another one just like him. So I went looking for this breed that I didn't want in the beginning, and found all kinds of breeders responding. And I just couldn't find one I was looking for until I found this incredible breeder down south. And it's a big part of the story, as you know. And as I say, Maxwell Garrison Gillis opened the door, And when he left it open, and Atticus Maxwell Finch walked in soon after.
Mm. You named him after your favorite character, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes, with a little bit of Max in the middle.
There you go. So at what point, you guys start hiking, and at what point did you decide to sell the newspaper? And it was around the death of your friend, I know that. But what made you decide to sell the newspaper? What made you decide to move to New Hampshire?
Well, a lot goes on in between. When I got Atticus, the breeder had me carry him everywhere I went the first month we were together. And it created this incredible bond where he could go leashless. He hasn't had a leash or collar on for years. Even on our book tour, going through some of the cities, it's funny, some looks he gets as he's walking side by side with me.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And it created a nice sense of trust for us. Well, we started hiking with a brother, invited us to go for a hike, and it just progressed more and more, and we decided to hike each of the 48 4,000 footers of New Hampshire in one summer. We did it 11 weeks, and then we tried to replicate that that next winter. Only one dog had ever hiked the 48,000 footers in winter, and that was a Newfoundland, 160-pound dog. Mm. And once again, ignorance was bliss. And we set out to do it, and we fell short by a couple of hikes, but it got us ready for winter. And when a friend of mine died for cancer, I decided I wanted to do something to honor her memory. And she loved children, and she had run for school committee, and she had asked me and Atticus to stand in front of the church and give her eulogy. But when she died, her family changed her plans.
Mm.
They didn't think it was appropriate that a muckraking newspaper editor and a little dog would be giving her glorious story to the town to hear. So I was thinking about what I could do for her. And Atticus and I were driving north one time and saw the mountains and was thinking about Vicky and listening to a radiothon with kids fighting cancer. And listening to these three-year-old kids talk about fighting cancer the way you and I would talk about going down the street, get an ice cream cone, or listening
right.
to parents talking about three-year-old kids who died of cancer, and how could you not cry, and how would your heart not go out to them? And I thought of Vicky, and I thought of the mountains, and I thought of the kids, and Vicky's motto in running for office was for the kids. So I decided to do something for the kids with cancer in Vicky's name, and Atticus and I would try to do what no man or dog had ever done, and try to hike each of the 48 4,000 footers twice in one winter. So 96 peaks in 90 days to raise money in her name.
That's a lot of hiking. And, you know, you normally think of little dogs like that being up to it, but he certainly is.
Oh, he was more up to it than this fat newspaper editor with a fear of heights.
Well, I want to read this and then have you tell me what you mean by this, or tell our listeners, because I read the book, so I know. But on the book cover, you say, in the mountains, Atticus became more of what he'd always been. I became less frantic, less stressed, less worried, less harried. I felt comfortable letting him lead, and he seemed to know what I needed. And then on your blog, you say, I have a secret for you. It's not about the mountains. It never has been about them. So what is it about? What was it about?
Are you familiar with Joseph Campbell, the mythologist that Bill Moyers interviewed?
I read everything he's ever written.
Yeah, you know, the whole monomyth, the hero's journey.
Yeah,
we're going through life, we're minding our own business, we're screwing up because we've not followed our bliss, and something comes along. I mean, in The Lord of the Rings, this wizard knocks on the door and tells this little chubby hobbit, hey, you're going on an adventure. the police stealing my trash, and somehow this little unwanted, neglected miniature schnauzer comes into my life. He dies, and I get another one. And what happens is thrown into... Well, fate comes knocking on the door and sort of says, wake up. There's an adventure you've been missing out on. And by going on this adventure, you're going to come back to who you always wanted to be when you were younger. You've sort of lost your way. And I think that's what the hero's journey is all about. You go off on something, and it could be any test you go on. It could be a woman fighting cancer. It could be a person trying to find their place in life. It could be someone who wanted to run a marathon. But it's becoming more than you ever were before. And through it all... you have to pass these obstacles and these tests, but oftentimes you need an avatar or a guide to get you through there. And I think Atticus, well, Max first, and then Atticus were instrumental in being that catalyst for my change. Mm-hmm. And those mountains proved to be the testing ground to get me to where I needed to go.
Yeah, I did a very put an informal question up on my Facebook page about how a pet has changed your life or what it's done for you, and I was just staggered by the responses. You know, people said comforted by their attention and appreciation. Petting them calms down anger, fear. There's obviously the companionship, which we think of, teaches me true trust. Joyful greetings that bring a smile. I mean, the list went on. What is it that Maxwell has done to you as a man? You say that you now feel like you ended the book with that saying, perhaps love is the process of gently leading you back to yourself. And you say that you, in the end, became the man I dreamed of being when I was a little boy. So tell us about that, because you were a son, you were the last child to be born. You were one of nine, right? Your mother died at six.
My mother died when I was 7 years old. She burned to death in a hospital fire. And my father was left raising nine children. I was the youngest. And as bad enough as it was, we were already Irish Catholic, so there was enough dysfunction going along as it was before all the tragedy hit. And he did the best he could. But how do you prepare for something like that? And people just sort of ran for their lives. And being the youngest one left behind, it's like, fend for yourself. And, you know, it took me a while to find my way in life, to find my purpose in life. But I think first having Max, taking care of him and realizing, instead of just taking care of myself in life, instead of just looking after myself, I was looking after someone else for a change. And then Atticus coming in as an eight-month-old puppy was a chance to start from scratch and treat someone well. I write in the book, as you've seen, that I get to raise him as if I wished to be raised.
Yeah.
And as you know, throughout the book, the breeder, Paige Foster, plays a large part in teaching me how to raise him and pretty much saying whatever dysfunction you have in your life will show up in his life, multiplied. So clean up your life. And I felt, since Max had not had much of a life until we came together, and I wish my life had been a little bit different. In my 40s, I didn't think I'd ever be married or have children at this point, so this is about my closest chance to have a family. So by giving Atticus a good life, it also helped me have a better life.
Right, right. And I love that in the book you say please and thank you to your dog, because I say please and thank you to mine, and people look at me as though I'm demented. They say, you know, he can't understand, but they understand tone, they understand intent. Why do you talk to your dog that way?
Well, like I said, I treat him the way I wish I'd been treated growing up.
Mm.
I have to tell you about HarperCollins, our publisher. I am thrilled with our editor, Cassie Jones Morgan. When publicity and marketing came forward and they started saying Tom Ryan with the dog or master and owner, I was like, no, we never use the word master. We don't use the word owner. And it's not Tom Ryan as a dog. And someone said, well, why not? That's what he is. I said, well, if you and your wife went off and did this great adventure, you wouldn't say Bill Smith and his wife. You'd say Bill and Janet Smith went off to this and did this. HarperCollins from the beginning picked up the tone that I learned from Paige Foster, that this is a friendship. This is a partnership. And so if it's Tom, it's Atticus. If it's Ryan, it's Finch. If it's Tom Ryan, former newspaper editor, it's Atticus and Finch, miniature schnauzer. No, I don't know anything about raising a dog. I just lucked into it with a great breeder who gave me some great advice, and I treated him the way I wished I'd been treated, and I treated him the way I wished Max had been treated before he came into my life, and it worked wonders for us.
Mm. So you've been on all these treks up the 48 peaks, the 4,000-foot peaks. Mm-hmm. Did you have a scariest moment up there, Tom?
Oh, all of them. I'm afraid of heights. I'm afraid of the dark. Oh, my God. Jeez. You know, you have to pitch a book to an agent. You have to pitch it to the publisher, and you have to have that one sentence as the hook. And my hook was little dogs, middle-aged, overweight, out-of-shape newspaper editors with a paralyzing fear of heights still belong in the mountains, especially in the winter. So what the hell were they doing up there? Everything, just being away from the nonstop noise of the city and being a newspaper editor of my own paper and the phone constantly ringing and the constant stress, which we get addicted to, that was all scary. It was all exciting, but it was scary. It was stepping off into that abyss, become something I didn't know what we were going to become. But then going out in winter and being caught in a blizzard, as you read about on the bombs, and a 23-mile hike, it was the first time I thought we might die out there.
Mm-hmm.
Storm came out of nowhere, and suddenly we're waist or knee deep in snowdrifts, and Atticus pushing through, and myself and a friend. And it was, you know, there were times it was just frightening, but at the same time, always looking at Atticus, I was always amazed. He always had a choice through all this, Vicky. He had a choice to turn back, which he's decided to do on occasion. He's had a choice not to hike on certain days. He's jumped out of the car, felt the weather, and jumped right back and said, no freaking way we're going out today. And so I was like, all right, you have the say. But seeing what he would be willing to do and letting him lead, it emboldened me to follow. That's why it's following Atticus and not following Tom. I mean, God, he'd be a real mess if he followed me. I ran into one fellow who said to me one day, he said, I was going up, climbing up Pond Cliff above tree line. My dog wouldn't go. The storm was raging. He wouldn't go, so I had to kick him to get him to go. He said, Jeez. What would you have done? I said, if I was there? And he said, yes. I said, I would have kicked you.
There you go.
So I think the most important thing throughout all this is Atticus and myself have a partnership, and it was important to me that he understood he always had a say, and I paid attention to what that say was, what he felt like doing.
Yeah, I like that partnership thing. I've said it to my dog on the very rare occasion he's a little naughty. I'll say, hey, we're supposed to be partners here, Betty. I don't want to be telling you off. So,
well, see, you and I are the opposite. Your dog might be a little bit naughty, but Atticus, with us, is the well-behaved one. I'm the one who screws up more than us.
So, what funniest story? Share a funny story with us, Tom.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm trying to keep it clean, Vicky. One of these things, I get in trouble on the tour when I'm doing radio shows. I'm like, oh, I'm just talking to this nice woman on the phone. I can tell her anything, but I forget about all your listeners out there, too. I think Mount Washington, which I put in the book, up here, it's a place where about 140 people have died through the years. Its average wind speed in winter is 45 miles an hour. Average temperature is 5 degrees. And really being selective on the day I would first bring Atticus up there with his bodysuit and his boots. And we found a perfect day where there's going to be a window of about 3 hours where there's going to be very low wind. So Atticus and I climbed the highest peak in the northeast, and we got to the top. It was probably about 25 degrees, very little wind, maybe 15 miles an hour, and it seemed warm, relatively speaking. We had it to ourselves, which is unusual. And we're sitting there eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich on the summit, when off in the distance, this group of climbers come walking like a human centipede. They have all the expensive gear. They have ropes. They have the goggles on. They have parkers made for Mount Everest. They have ice axes. And they've hired a guide for over $1,000 to get to the top of this very dangerous mountain. And they're stockbrokers and doctors and attorneys from New York. And I'm sure they've come to challenge death and spit in the eye of death so they can go home to these bars in New York and brag to these women and say, look what we did this weekend. Look at the pictures we took up there in this mountain.
Right.
And as I say in the book, when they got to the top, they saw something much more horrifying than death. They came to a fat guy and a little dog eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich on the summit.
Funny.
And as they approached us, one of them finally, they were stopped. They were walking lockstep together like a human centipede. And finally one of them said, how did you get here? And I said, we walked. And I waited for a minute, and I watched them. And all their expensive gear was brand new and shiny, and I looked at their guide, and I said, and how did you get here? Visa?
Oh, very, yes, very good. Visa. I was going to say very expensively, yeah. very good. We're right at the end of our segment now, but I know you say you owe much to your dog, Maxwell, who died, and even more to the one who lived, Atticus Maxwell Finch. Max sent you on your way, but it was Atticus who led you home again. And I love this. He said he taught you about love, about kindness of your fellow man, about daring to dream and finding a way to love your embattled father. A final thought you'd like to leave us with, Tom?
Everyone always asks me what the book is about, Vicky. And I learned a lot from the book tour by talking to different people, what they've gotten out of it. And it's about transformation. It's about the idea of finding your place in life. Someone said, do you need a dog to do it? No, maybe a horse, or maybe your child will lead you there. But it's rediscovering the innocence we once had. And I think dogs can do that for us if we're smart enough to listen to them and pay attention with lead us. I mean, a horse could do it. Children could do it. But it's the idea of reclaiming what we lost along the way.
Yeah.
No one grows up thinking I'm going to be an alcoholic or work 80 hours a week or beat my children. You think these grand dreams of what life's going to be like, and I think we forget about it along the way, and sometimes we need to be reminded.
And this was a terrific reminder. I'm not just saying this, but this is going to go on my favorite bookshelf, as one of my favorite books. Tom Ryan is my guest. Following Atticus, 48 High Peaks, One Little Dog, and An Extraordinary Friendship is his book, and you can find out more about them at tomandatticusdog.blogspot.com. I can't even speak now. TomandAtticus.blogspot.com. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.